the gorge and dangle it in the water. Then watch it. When you see a nibble, with luck, a quick jerk will pull the gorge so that it's horizontal across the throat or mouth with the two points stuck in either side. Even youngsters can get quite good.
Jandalar was smiling.
I know. You taught me when I was young, he said,
then looked at Ayla.
Don't get Bramival started talking about fishing.
The leader looked slightly embarrassed.
Ayla fishes too, Bramival.
The man smiled at the woman.
She can catch fish with her bare hands.
With your bare hands?
Bramival said.
Now that's something I'd like to see.
It takes a lot of patience, but it's not hard, Ayla said. I'll show you sometime.
After leaving the narrow gorge of Little Valley, Ayla noticed that the huge mass of limestone called Big Rock, which formed the north side of the 14th cave's small vale, soared up steeply. But unlike High Rock, did not crowd close to the river. After several yards, the path widened out as the tall limestone walls that lined the right bank pulled back from the edge of the water, until a large field separated the stone walls from the flowing river.
This is called the Gather Field, Jandalar said. It's another place that's used by all the caves around here. When we all want to get together for a gathering, like a feast or a meeting to let everyone know something, this place is big enough to hold us. We sometimes use it after a big hunt to dry the meat for winter. I suppose if there was a stone shelter here, or a usable cave, it would have been claimed, but anyone can use it now, mostly in summer when a tent is a good enough shelter to stay in for a few days.
Ayla looked across at the limestone wall. Though there were no usable abris or deep caves, the face of the cliff was split by ledges and crevices where birds nested.
I used to climb that wall a lot when I was young, Jandalar said. There are all kinds of lookout perches and a spectacular view of the river valley.
The youngsters still do, Willemar said.
Beyond the gather field and just downstream from the ninth cave, another ridge of limestone cliffs crowded close to the river. Here, the forces that had eroded the stone of the cliff had created a rounded, bulging appearance that rose to the top, and, like all the limestone cliffs and overhangs, the warm, yellowish, natural color of the stone was streaked with shades of dark gray. The trail climbed up a rather steep slope from the river to a sizable level terrace that extended beyond a row of substantial rock shelters, separated in places by sheer rock walls that had no protective overhangs. From the south, several simple structures of hide and wood were seen under the bulging overhang of rock shelters. They were constructed in the pattern of a longhouse, with a row of hearths down the middle paralleling the cliff wall. Two fairly large stone shelters at the northern end of the terrace, about 50 yards apart, were almost contiguous with the enormous overhanging rock shelter of the ninth cave. But because of the way the cliff curved, the shelters did not face south, which Ayla felt made this place less desirable. She looked down at the southerly end of the terrace of the ninth cave, beyond a spring-fed stream that ran off the edge of the stone porch, and she realized that this ledge was somewhat higher in elevation.
"Which cave claims this place?"
Ayla asked.
"No cave really claims it," Jandalar said. "It's called Downriver, probably because it's just downriver from the ninth cave. The runoff of the spring that rises out of the back wall has worn through the stone porch that makes a natural division between the ninth cave and Downriver. We made a bridge to connect the two places. The ninth cave probably uses it more than any other, but all of the caves use it."
"What do they use it for?"
Ayla asked.
"For making things. It's a place to work. People come here to work on their crafts, especially crafts that use hard materials."
Ayla noticed then that the whole terrace of Downriver, but especially within and around the area of the two northernmost debris, was littered with a refuse of ivory, bone, antler, wood, and stone from napping flint and making tools, hunting weapons, and various implements.
"Jandalar, I'm going on ahead," Joharan said. "We're almost home, and I know you want to stay here and tell Ayla all about Downriver."
The rest of the people of the ninth cave went on with him. It was dusk and would soon be dark.
The first of these stone shelters is used mostly by those who work flint, Jandalar said. Flint leaves a lot of sharp pieces when you work it. It's best to keep them in one place.
Then he looked around and saw that the debitage of chips and flakes left behind in the process of making knives, spear points, scrapers, the chisel-like tools called burins, and other weapons and tools out of the hard siliceous stone was all over.
Well, he smiled, that was the original idea.
He told her that most of the stone tools made here were taken to the second rock shelter to be attached to handles made out of other materials, such as wood or bone, and many of those would then be used to make other things out of the same hard materials, but there were no hard and fast rules about what was made where. They often worked together. For example, the worker who shaped flint into a knife blade often collaborated closely with the one who made the handle for it, perhaps chipping a bit more off the tang of the blade to fit into the handle better, or suggesting that the haft be modified or thinned for better balance. Or the shaper of a bone spear point might ask the flint knapper to sharpen a tool, or suggest a way to rework it to make it easier to use. Or the carver who decorated the handle or shaft might want a special chisel point, and only a skilled and experienced knapper could detach a burin spall off the end of the flint implement at just the right angle to get the desired result. Jandalar greeted a few crafters who were still around the second stone shelter at the north end of the terrace, working on some project, and introduced Ayla. They eyed the wolf warily, but went back to work after the animal and the couple passed on.
"It's getting dark," Ayla said. "Where will those people sleep?"
"They could come to the ninth cave, but they'll probably light a fire and stay up late, and then spend the night in one of those sleeping lodges under the first shelters we passed," he explained. "They're trying to finish before tomorrow. If you recall, there were many more crafters here earlier today. The rest have either gone home or are staying with friends at the ninth cave."
"Does everyone come here to work on projects?" Ayla asked.
"Every cave has a work site like this near their living area, usually smaller, but whenever crafters have a question or an idea to work out, they come here," Jandalar said.
He went on to explain that it was also where a young person was taken who had developed an interest and wanted to learn something about a particular craft. It was a good place to discuss things, such as the quality of flint from various regions and the best uses for each variety, or to exchange views about techniques about anything, how to cut down a tree with a flint axe, or remove suitable pieces of ivory from a mammoth tusk, or cut a tine off an antler, or bore a hole through a shell or a tooth, or shape and pierce beads, or rough out an approximate shape for a bone spear point. It was the place to discuss acquiring raw material, and to plan trips or trading missions to get it. And not least, it was a good place to just talk about who was interested in whom, who was having problems with a mate or a mate's mother, whose daughter, son, or hearth child had taken a first step, or spoken a new word, or made a tool, or found a good patch of berries, or tracked an animal, or made a first kill. Ayla quickly got the idea that it was a place for both serious work and friendly camaraderie.
"We'd better get going before it's too dark to find our way," Jandalar said, "especially since we don't have torches. Besides, if we are going hunting tomorrow, there are a few things we will need, too, and we'll be off early."
The sun had already set, though the last glimmerings of light colored the sky overhead when they finally headed down toward the bridge over the runoff creek from the spring. They crossed over to the end of the shelter of stone that was the home of Jandalar and his people, the ninth cave of the Zelandanyi. As the path leveled out, Ayla noticed that the light from several fires ahead was reflected off the underside of the limestone overhang. It was a welcoming sight. For all the protection of the animal spirits that helped to define her, only people knew how to make fire. Chapter 12. It was still dark when they heard a light tap on the doorpost.
The Zelandanya are preparing the hunting ceremony,
a voice said.
We'll be right there, Jandalar said quietly.
They were already awake, but not dressed. Ayla had been fighting down a bit of nausea and trying to decide what to wear, not that she had much to choose from. She would have to make herself some clothes. Perhaps she would be able to get a hide or two from their kill today. She looked again at the sleeveless tunic and calf-length leggings, the boy's underwear Morona had given to her, and made a decision. Why not? It was a comfortable outfit, and it would probably be hot later today. Jandalar watched her put on the clothing Morona had given her, but didn't say anything. It had been given to her, after all. She could use it for anything she wanted. He looked up when he saw his mother coming out of her sleeping place.
Mother, I hope we didn't wake you,
Jandalar said. You didn't wake me. I still feel an edge of excitement just before a hunt, even though I haven't gone hunting for years, Marthona said. I suppose that's why I like to be involved in the planning and the rituals. I'm going to the ceremony, too.
We both are,
Willemar said, stepping out from behind the screen that divided their sleeping room from the rest of the dwelling.
I'm coming, too, Falara said, her sleepy-eyed, tousled head looking around the edge of her screen. She yawned and rubbed her eyes.
I just need a little time to get dressed.
Suddenly, her eyes opened wide.
Ayla, are you wearing that?
Ayla looked down at herself, then stood up straight.
This was given to me as a gift, she said with a touch of defensive belligerence, and I intend to wear it. Besides, she added with a smile, I don't have many clothes, and this is easy to move in. If I tie a cloak or a fur around me, it will be warm in the chill of the morning, but later, when it gets hot, it will be cool and comfortable. It really is a very practical outfit.
There was a moment of awkward silence. Then Willemar chuckled.
You know, she's right. I would have never thought of wearing winter underwear as summer hunting clothes, but why not?
Marthona studied Ayla carefully, then gave her a shrewd smile.
If Ayla wears that outfit, she said, people will talk. Older women will disapprove, but under the circumstances some will feel she's justified, and by this time next year half the young women will be wearing the same thing.
Jandalar visibly relaxed.
Do you really think so, Mother?
He hadn't known what to say when he saw Ayla putting on the clothes. Morona had given them to her for the sole purpose of causing her embarrassment. But it occurred to him that if his mother was right, and Marthona was seldom wrong about such things, it would be Morona who would be not only embarrassed, but not allowed to forget it. Every time she saw someone wear such an outfit, it would remind her that her spiteful trick had not pleased anyone. Falara was looking dumbfounded, glancing from her mother to Ayla, then back to Marthona again.
You'd better hurry if you're coming, Falara, the older woman chided. It will be daylight soon.
Willemar lit a torch from the banked fire in the cooking room while they waited. It was one of several they had prepared after they had walked into a dark dwelling the night Ayla taught them how to make fire with flint and iron pyrite. When Falara came out, still trying to tie her hair back with a strip of leather, they moved the leather drape aside and slipped out quietly. Ayla bent down to touch Wolf's head, a signal in the dark for him to stay close as they walked toward several bobbing firelights in the direction of the stone front porch. Quite a number of people were already congregated on the front ledge when the residents of Marthona's dwelling, including the wolf, appeared. Some were holding stone oil lamps, which shed just enough light in the dark for them to find their way, but burned for some time. Others held torches, which gave more light, but burned out faster. They waited a while longer, until a few more people joined them. Then the whole group started toward the south end of the abris. It was difficult to distinguish individuals, or even see where they were going when they started out. The torches carried by some lighted the space around them, but made everything beyond the glow of the light seem blacker. Ayla kept her hand on Jandalar's arm as they walked along the stone ledge, past the uninhabited section of the ninth cave's cliff overhang, to the gully that separated the ninth cave from downriver. The small creek that ran through the trench The runoff of the fresh spring welling up out of the back wall was a handy source of water for the craftspeople when they were working, and during bad weather, an extra source for the ninth cave as well. The torchbearers stood at either end of the bridge that led up to the stone shelters of downriver. In the flickering light, each person walked carefully on the logs that were lashed together and laid across the small gully. Ayla thought the sky was beginning to turn from true black to the deep midnight blue of pre-dawn, the first sign that the sun would soon be breaking, but stars still filled the night sky. There were no fires burning in the two large shelters of downriver. The last of the crafters had long since retired to the sleeping lodges. The hunting party passed by the lodges, then continued down the steep path to the gather field between high rock and the river. From quite a distance away they could see the large bale fire in the middle of the field and the people around it. When they drew near, Ayla noted that, like the torches, the fire lighted the space around it but made it difficult to see beyond. Fire was wonderful to have at night, but there were limitations. They were met by several of the Zelandanya, including the one who was first among those who served the mother, the Zelandani of the ninth cave. The large woman greeted them and told them where they would stand for the ceremony. As she walked away, her broad silhouette almost blocked the light from the fire, but only for a moment. More people were arriving. Ayla recognized Bremaval in the firelight and realized it was a group from the 14th cave. She glanced up and was aware that the sky had definitely become deep blue. Then another group of people carrying torches appeared, Kareja and Manvalar among them. The 11th and 3rd caves had arrived. Manvalar motioned to Joharan, then approached him.
"I wanted to tell you, I think we should go after the giant deer today, rather than the bison," Manvalar said. "When the watchers came up last evening after you left, they said the bison have moved away from the surround trap. It won't be easy to chase them into it now."
Joharan looked disappointed for a moment, but hunting always did require flexibility. Animals roamed where they chose for their own needs, not for a hunter's convenience. A successful hunter was adaptable.
"All right, let's tell Zelandani," he said.
At a signal, everyone moved to an area between the fire and the rear of the field, facing the back wall. The closeness of the fire and the crowd of people raised the temperature, and Ayla savored the warmth. The exercise of walking to the gather field at a fairly good pace, in spite of the darkness, had served to keep her warm enough, but standing around waiting had caused her to begin to feel the chill. The wolf pressed against her leg. He was not happy having so many strange people so close. Ayla knelt down to reassure him. The reflection of the large fire behind them danced on the rough, vertical surface of the rock. Suddenly a loud wailing sounded, and the staccato of drums. Then she heard another sound, and felt the hair rising at the nape of her neck and a shiver down her spine. She had heard a sound like that only once before. At the clan gathering. She would never forget the sound of a bull roarer. It was the sound that called in the spirits. She knew how the sound was made. It came from a flat, oval-shaped piece of wood or bone with a hole at one end by which a cord was attached. Spinning the object around by the cord produced the eerie wailing roar, but knowing how it was made in no way changed the effect it had. A sound like that could come only from the spirit world. That wasn't what gave her the chill, however. What was hard to believe was that the Zelandanyi would have a ceremony that called in the spirits the same way the clan did. Ayla crowded close to Jondalar, wanting the assurance of him near her. Then her attention was caught by a movement in the fire's reflection on the wall that was more than firelight. A shadow in the shape of a giant deer with large palmate antlers and a hump on his withers had flickered through it. She turned around and looked back but didn't see anything, and wondered if she had imagined it. She turned back to face the wall, and the antlered deer flickered through again, then a bison. The bull roarer tapered off, but another sound had begun, at first so low that she was barely conscious of it. Then the low, wailing chant increased in pitch and a heavy, rhythmical booming began. The wailing interweaved in counterpoint to the swelling sound that reverberated off the back wall as both grew louder. Ayla's temples throbbed to the steady thrum, 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 and her heart pounded in her ears at the same tempo and just as loud. It seemed that her limbs had turned to ice, and her legs refused to move. She was petrified. She broke out in a cold sweat. Then, abruptly, the pounding stopped and the wailing began to form words. "Oh, spirit of the giant deer, we praise you." "We praise you," voices around her repeated the phrase, but they were not quite all together. The chanting background grew louder. "Spirit of bison, we want you near. We praise you." "We praise you." This time the hunters spoke in unison. "The mother's children want you here. We call you." "We call you." "Immortal soul, no death you fear. We praise you." "We praise you." The voices were louder now. "Your mortal lives are drawing near. We call you." The tone was growing high-pitched, expectant. "We call you." The voices were louder still. "Give them to us and shed no tear. We praise you." "We praise you." "The mother wills it, do you hear? We call you." Now it was demanding. "We call you. We call you. We call you." They were shouting. Ayla's voice had joined the rest, though she wasn't even aware of it. Then she noticed a large figure taking form on the rough wall. A barely visible dark figure was moving in front of the wall, somehow causing the shape of a giant deer to take form. A mature male with large antlers that seemed to breathe in the dawning light. The hunters kept repeating in a low, monotonous drone in rhythm with the deep, booming drum. "We call you, we call you, we call you, we call you. Give them to us. Shed no tear. The mother wills it. Hear, hear, hear." The voices nearly screamed. Suddenly a light seemed to turn on, and a loud wailing cry was heard that ended in a death rattle. "She hears," the chanting voice said abruptly. All sound suddenly ceased. Ayla looked up, but the deer was gone. Only the first bright beam of light of the sunrise remained. There was no sound or movement at first. Then Ayla became conscious of breathing and shuffling movements. The hunters appeared dazed and were looking around as though they had just awakened. Ayla heaved a great sigh, then knelt down again and hugged the wolf. When she looked up, Proliva was there, handing her a cup of hot tea. Ayla murmured her thanks and sipped the tea gratefully. She was thirsty and no longer feeling the nausea of morning sickness, she realized, though she wasn't sure when it had stopped. Perhaps on the hike to the gather field. She and Jandalar, with Wolf close by, walked with Joharan and his mate back to the fire where the hot tea had been made. They were joined by Marthona and Willemar and Folara.
"Courageous says she has a disguise for you, Ayla," Joharan said. "We can pick it up when we pass by the 11th cave."
Ayla nodded, not quite sure what a disguise was or how it would be used to hunt giant deer. Then she looked around to see who else was in the hunting party. She recognized Rushamar and Soliban and was not surprised. She would expect to see the leader's advisers, the ones Joharan always turned to for assistance. She was startled to see Brukhaval and then wondered why. He was, after all, a member of the 9th cave. Why shouldn't he hunt with them? She was even more surprised to see Morona's friend, Portula. But when the woman saw her, she flushed, stared for a moment, then turned away.
"I don't think Portula expected to see you wearing those clothes," Marthona said quietly to Ayla.
The sun was climbing the great blue vault, and the hunters set out quickly, leaving behind those who were not joining the hunt. As they headed toward the river, the warm sun dissipated the somber mood wrought by the ceremony, and the conversation, held in quiet whispers earlier in the morning, reached a more normal tone. They spoke seriously but confidently about the hunt. Their mission might not be assured, but the familiar ritual had addressed the spirit of the giant deer and the bison, just in case, and had focused everyone's attention on the hunt, and the phantom manifestation on the back wall of the gather field had reinforced their spiritual bonds with the world beyond the material one. Ayla felt a dampness in the air from a morning mist rising near the water. She glanced to the side and caught her breath at the sheer unexpected beauty of a momentary natural phenomenon. Twigs and leaves and blades of grass, highlighted by a beam of light, sparkled with the brilliance of every rainbow color caused by the refraction of sunlight through the prisms of droplets. Even the symmetrical perfection of a spider's web, whose sticky strands were designed to capture that predator's quarry, had snared, instead, jeweled drops of condensed moisture along its slender threads. "Jandalar, look!" she said, calling his attention to the display. Falara stopped, too, then Willemar.
"I would take that as a favorable sign," the trade master said, smiling broadly before moving on.
Where the river widened, the water foamed and tumbled over its pebble-strewn bed, but parted around larger rocks, unable to entice them to join in the playful dance of white water and shimmering ripples. The hunters started across the river at the broad shallows, stepping from stone to stone through the deeper middle. Some of the large rocks were brought there by a more turbulent stream of a different season during past years, and some were carried there recently to fill in the gaps left by nature. As Ayla followed the others, her thoughts turned toward the upcoming hunt. Then, just as she was about to start across, she suddenly stopped.
"What's wrong, Ayla?"
Jandalar asked with a concerned frown.
"Nothing's wrong," she said. "I'm going back to get the horses. I'll be able to catch up before the hunters reach Two Rivers Rock. Even if we don't use the horses for hunting, they can help carry the kill back."
Jandalar nodded. "That's a good idea. I'll come with you," he said. Then, turning to Willemar, "Will you tell Joharan we've gone back for the horses? It won't take long."
"Come on, Wolf," Ayla said,
as they headed back toward the ninth cave. But the way Jandalar went was not the way they had come. After reaching the gather field, instead of taking the steep path up to downriver and on to the ninth cave across the stone ledges, he led them along a lesser-used and somewhat overgrown trail along the right bank of the river in front of the shelters of stone. Depending on the bends and turns the waterway took across its floodplain, the path was sometimes beyond a grassy field that was between the ledge and the river, and sometimes close to the stone front porch. There were several paths leading up to the shelters along the way, and one Ayla recalled using when she'd had to relieve herself after that long meeting about the clan. The memory prompted her to use the place again. She had to pass water more frequently now that she was pregnant. Wolf sniffed her water. He seemed more interested in it lately, and she wondered if he could tell she was expecting. A few people noticed them walking back and waved or beckoned. Jandalar was sure they were curious about why they had returned, but he didn't respond. They'd find out soon enough. When they reached the end of the line of cliffs, they turned into Wood Valley, and Ayla whistled. Wolf raced ahead.
"Do you think he knows we're going to get Winnie and Racer?"
Ayla said.
"I wouldn't doubt it," Jandalar said. "I'm always amazed at what he seems to know."
"Here they come,"
Ayla said, her voice full of happiness. She realized she hadn't seen them for more than a day and had missed them. Winnie nickered when she saw Ayla and went straight to her with her head held high, but she lowered it over the woman's shoulder while Ayla hugged her neck. Racer let out a loud neigh and pranced toward Jandalar with his tail high and his neck arched, then presented his favorite scratching places to the man.
"I've missed them, but I think they've missed us, too," Ayla said.
After some greetings, scratchings, and strokings, and nose-touchings with Wolf, she suggested they go up and get riding blankets and Winnie's harness for the pole drag.
"I'll go," Jandalar said. "We'd better get going if we're planning on hunting today, and everybody will be asking questions. I think it will be easier for me to say we have to hurry. If you do it, someone may take it wrong, since they don't really know you yet."
"And I don't really know them," Ayla said. "That's a good idea. I'll check the horses over and make sure they're all right. Bring the carrying baskets, too, and a water bowl for Wolf, and maybe the sleeping rolls. Who knows where we'll be staying tonight? You should probably bring Winnie's halter, too. They caught up with the rest of the hunting party just as they were reaching Two Rivers Rock. They had ridden along the river, splashing along the edge of the left bank after crossing.
"I was beginning to wonder if you'd make it back before we started," Courageous said. "I did stop off and pick up a disguise for you, Ayla."
Ayla thanked her, but still wondered what a disguise was and how it would be used. At the Two Rivers confluence, the hunting party turned into Grass Valley. Kimmeran and some people from the second and seventh caves who were joining them but had not gone to the ceremony at the gather field had waited upstream. When the rest of the hunters reached them, they stopped for a strategy meeting. Ayla and Jondalar got down from the horses and moved closer to listen.
"The Fona said the bison were moving north 2 days ago," Manvalar was saying. "It looked as if they would be in a good position by today, but they changed direction and headed east, away from the surround. The Fona's one of our best. She can see farther than anyone, and she's been watching that herd for some time. I think they will be in a good position to chase into the trap soon, but probably not today. That's why we thought the Megaceros would be a better choice. They watered up river from here, and now they're browsing on leaf greens near the tall grass." "How many are there?" Joharan asked.
3 mature does, a yearling buck, 4 spotted young, and a stag with a good-sized rack," the Fona answered. "A typical small herd."
"I was hoping to get several animals, but I don't want to take them all. That's why I wanted the bison. They travel in bigger herds,"
Joharan said. "Except for giant deer and reindeer, most deer don't travel in herds at all. They like trees and more wooded places where it's easier to hide. You seldom see more than a few bucks or a doe or two and the young, except during the season when the males and females come together," the Fona said. Ayla was sure Joharan knew that, but the Fona was young and proud of the knowledge she had gained as a watcher. Joharan had followed her to recount what she had learned.
"I think we should leave the stag, and at least one of the does and her young one, if we can be sure it's hers," Joharan said.
Ayla thought that was a good decision. Again, she found herself impressed with Joharan and observed him more closely. Jondalar's brother was nearly a head shorter than he, but his stocky, powerful build left no doubt that he was the equal of most men in strength. Leadership of the large and sometimes unruly cave sat well on his shoulders. He exuded confidence. Brunn, the leader of her clan, would have understood him, she thought. He, too, had been a good leader, unlike Braud. Most of the Zelandanyi leaders she had met seemed well-suited to their position. Caves usually chose their leaders well, but had Joharan been unable to fulfill the position, the cave would have simply shifted toward a more adequate leader. Without formality, there were no rules needed to dispossess a leader. He simply would have lost his following. But Braud had not been chosen, she realized. He was destined to be the next leader from the moment he was born. Since he was born to the mate of a leader, it was believed he would have the memories for it. And perhaps he did, but in different proportions. Certain qualities that could contribute to leadership, such as pride, an ability to command and to elicit respect, were accentuated in Braud. Brunn's pride had come from the achievements of his clan, which also earned him respect, and he directed well because he paid attention to others, then decided. Braud's pride was exaggerated to hubris. He liked telling people what to do, but did not listen to seasoned advice, and he wanted respect for his own exploits. Though Brunn had tried to help him, Braud would never be the leader Brunn had been. As the meeting was breaking up, Ayla spoke quietly to Jondalar.
"I'd like to ride ahead and see if I can find the bison. Do you think Joharan would mind if I asked the Fona where she last saw them?"
"No, I don't think so. But why don't you mention it to him?" Jondalar said.
They both approached the leader, and when Ayla told him her plan, he said he had been going to ask the fauna the same thing.
"Do you think you can locate those bison?"
he asked. "I don't know, but they didn't seem to be very far, and Winnie can run much faster than a person can," Ayla said.
"But I thought you said you wanted to hunt the Megaseris with us,"
Joharan said. "I do, but I think I can scout ahead and still meet you where the deer are in time to join you," she said.
"Well, I wouldn't mind knowing where those bison are," Joharan said. "Let's go ask the fauna where they were."
"I think I'll go with Ayla," Jandalar said. "She isn't familiar with this region yet. She might not understand the fauna's directions."
"Go ahead, but I hope you make it back in time. I'd like to see those spear throwers of yours in action,"
Joharan said.
"If they do half of what you say they can, it could make a big difference."
After talking with the fauna, Ayla and Jandalar took off at a gallop, with Wolf loping behind, while the rest of the hunters continued to follow Grass River upstream. The countryside of Zelandanyi territory was a dramatic land, carved in high relief, with steep cliffs, broad river valleys, rolling hills, and elevated plateaus. The rivers sometimes meandered across meadows and fields with a gallery of trees along their banks, and at other times flowed beside high rock walls. The people who lived there were accustomed to its varied landscape and moved through it comfortably, whether it meant climbing a steep hillside or scaling a nearly vertical cliff, jumping across slippery stones to cross a river, or swimming upstream against its current, walking single file between a wall of rock on one side and a rushing river on the other, or spreading out on an open plain. The hunters broke up into small groups as they moved through the nearly waist-high but still green grass of the open field of the valley. Joharan kept watching for the return of his brother and his strange entourage, the foreign woman, two horses, and a wolf, hoping they would get back in time to join the hunt, though he knew it would not make much difference. With so many hunters and so few animals, there was little doubt they would be able to get the ones they wanted. It was mid-morning before the stag with prodigious antlers was sighted, and the hunters stopped to discuss deployment of those in pursuit. Joharan heard hoofbeats and turned around. With inadvertent but perfect timing, Jandalar and Ayla returned.
"We found them,"
Jandalar said in an excited whisper when they had dismounted. He would have shouted it if he hadn't noticed that the giant deer were very close.
"And they've changed direction again. They're heading toward the surround. I'm sure we could encourage them to move that way faster."
"But how far away are they?"
Joharan asked.
"We have to walk. The rest of us don't have horses to ride."
"Not very far. The surround was made by the third cave. It isn't that far from here. You could get there without too much trouble," Ayla said. "If you'd rather hunt bison, you can, Joharan."
"Actually, big brother, you could hunt both," Jandalar said.
"We're here now, and a deer in your sight is worth much more than two bison in a distant surround,"
Joharan said.
"But if this doesn't take too long, we may try for the bison later. Now, do you want to join the hunt?"
"Yes,"
Jandalar said. "I do," Ayla said at nearly the same time.
"Let's tie the horses to that tree over there by the stream, Jandalar. Maybe I should tie a restraint on Wolf, too. He can get excited about hunting and may want to help, but that could be a problem for the other hunters, or he could get in the way if he's not sure what to do."
While the decisions were made about tactics, Ayla studied the small herd, especially the stag. Ayla remembered the first time she saw a fully developed, mature Megaseris stag. This giant deer was much the same, somewhat taller than a horse at the withers, though certainly not as big as a mammoth. They were called giant deer because they were the most imposing of all the varieties of deer. But it wasn't the size of the animal itself that made them so impressive. It was the size of their antlers. Each one of the massive, palm-shaped, deciduous horns that emerged from their heads grew larger each year, and in a mature male could reach 12 feet in length. Ayla visualized the length of one antler as two men the size of Jandalar, with one standing on the other's shoulders. The size of their antlers precluded the forested habitat that was often preferred by many of their cousins. The Megaseras were deer of the open plains. Although they ate grass, especially the green tops of the tall grass varieties, and grazed more than other deer, they also browsed on young brush and trees and leafy herbaceous plants near streams when they could. Once giant deer reached their full growth, though their bones no longer enlarged, the enormous growing antlers added to the illusion that Megaseras stags increased in height and breadth with each season. Support of such huge racks required the deer to develop massive shoulder and neck muscles, which they did slightly over time to accommodate the greater weight of the enlarging antlers, and to evolve a distinctive hump on their withers where muscles, tendons, and connective tissue bunched together. It was a genetic manifestation of the species. Even the females had a marked, though smaller, hump. Such enormous musculature, however, made the heads of the Megaseras seem small, and those males that sported immense racks had heads that appeared disproportionately petite. While the leaders were discussing tactics, the disguises were taken out. Then Joharan and several others passed around skin bags of grease. Ayla crinkled her nose in distaste at the smell. "It's made from the musk glands in the legs of the deer and mixed with fat from just above the tail," Jandalar told her. "It covers our scent in case the wind shifts suddenly." Ayla nodded and began smearing the greasy mixture on her arms and underarms and her legs and groin. While Jandalar was putting on his deer disguise, Ayla struggled with hers. "Let me show you," Kareja said. She was already in hers. Ayla smiled gratefully as the woman showed her how to wear the cape-like hide covering with a deer head still attached. She picked up the antlers that were fastened to a separate headpiece, though she didn't understand what the extra wooden parts were for.
"This is heavy," Ayla said, surprised at the weight when she put on the antler headwear.
"And they're small ones from a young buck. You don't want that big stag to think you are competition," Kareja said.
"How does it stay balanced when you move?" Ayla said, trying to shift the antlers to a better position.
"That's what these are for," Kareja said, using the wooden supports to prop up the ungainly headdress.
"No wonder the Megaseras have such big necks," Ayla said. "They need muscles just to hold these up."
The hunters approached with the wind blowing in their faces, which carried the human scent away from the deer's sensitive noses. They stopped when they could see the animals. The giant deer were browsing on the tender young leaves of low-growing brush.
"Watch them," Jandalar said softly. "See how they eat for a while and then look up. Then they move a few steps forward and start to feed again. We're going to copy their motions. Take a few steps toward them, then dip your head just as though you were a deer who had just seen some juicy new leaves and stopped to take a bite. Then look up. Stand perfectly still while you're looking up. Don't look at him directly, but keep your eyes on that big stag and don't move at all when you see him looking at you. Now, we're going to spread out in the same pattern they make. We want them to think we're just another herd of deer while we get close to them. Keep your spears out of sight as much as possible. Hold them upright behind your antlers while you move, and don't move too fast," he explained.
Ayla listened intently to the instructions. This was interesting. She had spent years watching wild creatures, especially carnivores, but also animals she hunted. She had studied them closely, absorbing every detail. She taught herself to track them, and finally taught herself to hunt them. But she had never pretended to be an animal before. She first watched the rest of the hunters, then carefully observed the deer. Growing up, learning to understand the gestures and movements of the clan gave her an edge. She had a keen eye for detail, for the smallest movements made by the animals. She saw how they shook their heads to rid themselves of buzzing insects and quickly learned to imitate the movement. She unconsciously timed the movements, judging how long they kept their heads down and how long they looked around. She was excited by this new way to hunt and intrigued. She almost felt like a deer as she moved forward with the hunters toward their quarry.
Ayla picked out the animals she planned to aim for and was slowly moving toward it. At first, she thought she might try for a fat doe, but she decided she wanted antlers, so she changed her mind and chose the young buck instead. Jandalar had told her that the meat would be divided among all the people, but the hide, antlers, sinew, and whatever else might be useful belonged to the hunter who killed the animal. When the hunters were almost in the midst of the deer, she saw Joharan give a prearranged signal. The hunters gripped their spears in readiness. Ayla and Jandalar adjusted theirs in their spear throwers. She knew she could have cast her spear long before, but most of the hunters did not have spear throwers, and her throw would have frightened the rest of the deer away before the others were close enough to hurl theirs. When Joharan saw that everyone was ready, he gave another quick signal. Almost as one, the hunters flung their spears. Several of the huge deer threw up their heads, startled into flight before they realized they were already hit. The proud stag bugled a call as a signal to run, but only one doe and her calf followed him. It was so fast, so unexpected, the rest staggered as they strained to take a step and fell to their knees as he leapt away. The hunters went to check their kills, to humanely dispatch any animals that might still be alive, and to verify which one should be credited to whom. Each person's spears were marked with decorations that clearly identified to whom they belonged. All the hunters knew their own weapons in any case, but the distinguishing symbols left no doubt and avoided disputes. If more than one hunter's spear found the same mark, they tried to determine which one had made the kill. If it was not obvious, the kill was claimed by both and would be shared. It was quickly acknowledged that Ayla's smaller, lighter spear had found the young buck. Some of the hunters knew that the young male had been browsing on a low bush somewhat away from the rest of the deer and on the opposite side of their approach. Not an easy target, and apparently no one else had attempted it. At least no other spear had found it. People talked about not only the long-distance weapon, but her skill with it, and wondered how much practice it would take to match her. Some were willing to try, but others looked at the successful hunt and weren't sure they needed to make the effort. Manvalar approached Joharan and several others of the Ninth Cave, including Jandalar and Ayla.
"What did you find out about the bison?"
he asked. The planning and preparations for the hunt had built up an eager anticipation, but stalking the deer and dispatching them had been so quick and efficient it had left the hunters with a measure of excess energy that had not been used up.
"The herd was moving north again toward the surround," Jandalar said. "Do you really think that they might get close enough to it so we can take advantage of the surround today?"
Joharan asked.
"It's still early, and I wouldn't mind getting a few of those bison."
"We can make sure they do,"
Jandalar said.
"How?"
Kareja asked. Jandalar noticed there wasn't as much sarcasm in her tone as there had been the day before.
"Manvalar, do you know where the surround is and how long it would take the hunters to get there from here?"
"Yes, but the Fona can tell you that better than I," Manvalar said.
The young woman was not only a good lookout, she was a good hunter. She came forward when Manvalar mentioned her name and beckoned her.
"How far is it to the surround?"
She thought for a moment, looked up at the position of the sun in the sky, then said,
"If we set a good pace, we could get there not much after the sun is highest, I think. But the last time I saw them, the bison weren't that close to the surround."
"When we found them, they were heading in that direction, and I think we can speed them up with the help of the horses and wolf,"
Jandalar said.
"Ayla has done it before."
"What if you can't? What if we get there and there are no bison?"
Kimaran asked. He hadn't been around Jandalar much since his return, or Ayla, and though he'd heard many stories about his friend and the woman he'd brought back with him, he hadn't been exposed to as many of the surprises they had brought with them as some of the others. He hadn't seen them ride the horses until that morning, and wasn't at all sure about them.
"Then we will have nothing to show for our efforts, but it won't be the first time,"
Manvalar said. Kimaran shrugged and smiled wryly.
"I suppose that's true,"
he said.
"Does anyone else have any objections to trying for the bison?
We can just settle for the deer, Joharan said. We need to start butchering them anyway.
That's not a problem, Manvalar said. The Fona can lead you to the surround. She knows the way. I'll go back to Two Rivers Rock and organize some people to get started with the butchering and send a runner to the other caves to come and help. We'll need more help if you're lucky with the bison hunt.
I'm ready to try for the bison.
I'll go. Count me in.
Several people volunteered.
All right, Joharan said. You two go ahead and see what you can do about getting those bison started toward the surround. The rest of us will get there as fast as we can.
Ayla and Jandalar headed for the horses. Wolf was particularly glad to see them coming. He did not like being physically restrained. Ayla did not confine his movements often, and he wasn't used to it. The horses seemed to adjust to it more easily, but their activities were more often controlled. They mounted the horses and rode off at a fast pace, the wolf loping alongside them, leaving the people on foot watching as they quickly disappeared in the distance. It was true. Horses could certainly travel faster than people. They decided to go to the surround first, so they could judge how far away the bison were from it. Ayla was fascinated with the circular trap and took a little time to inspect it. It consisted of many small trees and logs filled in mostly with brush, but also with whatever they could find, such as bones and antlers. The surround had originally been constructed some years before, and it had moved somewhat from its original place. None of the trees from which it was made were sunk into the ground. Rather, they were lashed together, fixed firmly to each other, so that when some creature crashed into it, it wouldn't break through. The fencing had some give, some elasticity, and would instead move with a blow. Sometimes, with an extremely hard thrust, the entire structure shifted. It took a great deal of effort on the part of many people to cut down trees and branches and haul them to a logical site, especially on a largely treeless grassland, then erect a fence that could withstand the crush of heavy animals milling around inside it and the occasional assault by one maddened with fear. Each year, the parts that had fallen down or rotted away were repaired or replaced. They tried to keep it sound for as long as they could. It was easier to repair than entirely rebuild, especially since there were more than one at various strategic locations. This surround was located in a narrow valley between a limestone cliff on one side and steep hills on the other that was a natural migration route. At one time, a river had flowed through it, and a runoff stream still filled the dry bed occasionally. Hunters used it only sporadically. Animals seemed to learn quickly if a particular route was consistently dangerous and tended to avoid it. The ones who had come to repair the trap had also set up a portable fencing of panels that funneled the animals driven into the valley toward an opening in the surround. Usually, hunters had time enough to establish a cadre of people to stand behind the panels to harass any animals that attempted to bolt away back toward the trap. Since this was a rather unplanned, spontaneous hunt, no one was there yet. But Ayla did notice that some scraps of leather and cloth, pieces of woven belts and grass wands, long bunches of grass fastened to sticks, were tucked into the frames of the panels, or held down with stones.
Jandalar, she called to him.
He rode up to her. She had picked up a grass wand and a piece of leather.
Anything that flutters or moves in an unexpected way tends to spook bison, especially when they're running. At least that's what happened when we were driving bison toward the lion camp surround. These must be used to shake at animals heading toward the surround to keep them from breaking away. Do you think anybody would object if we borrowed a few? They could be useful when we were trying to drive the herd this way.
You're right. That is what they're for, Jandalar said, and I'm sure no one would mind if we borrow some, if it will help us get those bison here.
They left the valley and headed toward the place where they had last seen the herd.
The trail, trampled by the slowly moving animals, was easy to find, and they were a little closer to the valley than they were earlier. There were about 50 bison in all, males, females, and young. They were starting to come together to form the huge migratory herd that would develop later in the season. At certain times of the year, bison congregated in such huge numbers, it was like watching a sinuously moving river of dark brown spiked with large black horns. At other times, they broke up into smaller groupings, sometimes not much more than an extended family, but they preferred to form herds of some size. On the whole, there was safety in numbers. While predators, especially cave lions and packs of wolves, often brought down a bison from a herd, it was usually one that was slow or weak, which allowed the healthy and strong to survive. They approached the herd slowly, but the bison hardly noticed them. Horses were not animals that posed a threat, though they did give Wolf a wider berth. They were aware of him, but didn't panic. They merely avoided him, sensing that a single wolf could not take down an animal the size of a bison. Male bison were typically 6 feet 6 inches at the top of the hump on their shoulders and weighed a ton. They had long black horns and a beard that jutted forward from heavy jaws. Females were smaller, but both were quick and agile, able to climb steep slopes and leap over substantial obstacles. They could gallop, tail up and head down, in long strides across even rocky landscapes. Bison didn't water and could swim well, drying off their thick fur by rolling in the sand or dirt. They tended to graze in the evening and relaxed to chew their cud during the day. Their hearing and sense of smell were acute. Full-grown bison could be violent and aggressive, and they were difficult to kill with teeth and claws or with spears. But one bison provided 1,500 pounds of meat, plus fat, bones, skin, hair, and horns. Bison were proud and noble animals, respected by those who hunted them, and admired for their strength and courage.
"What do you think would be the best way to get them started?" Jandalar said. "Usually the hunters let them go at their own pace and try to guide them slowly toward the surround, at least until they get close."
"When we hunted on our journey here, we usually tried to get an animal to bolt away from the herd. This time, we want them all to keep going in the same direction, toward that valley," Ayla said. "I think riding up behind them and shouting would get them going, but if we wave these things at them, I think it would be a help, especially for the bison that tries to dash away. We don't want them stampeding in the wrong direction. Wolf always liked to chase them, too, and he got good at keeping them together."
She looked up at the sun and tried to estimate when they might arrive at the surround and wondered how close the hunters were. "Well, the important thing is to get them moving toward the track," she thought.
They moved around to the side opposite the direction they wanted to start them going. Then, looking at each other, they nodded and with a loud yell urged the horses toward the herd. Ayla was holding a grass wand in one hand and the scrap of leather in the other, both hands free because she didn't use a halter or a rein to direct Winnie. It had been an entirely spontaneous gesture the first time she got on the back of the horse, and she made no attempt to guide her. She simply clung to the horse's mane and let the animal run. She felt a sense of freedom and excitement as though she were flying like the wind. The horse slowed and headed back to the valley on her own. It was the only home she knew. Afterward, Ayla couldn't stop riding, but in the beginning the training was unconscious. Only later did she realize that she had been using the pressure and movement of her body to signal her intent. The first time Ayla hunted large game by herself after she left the clan, she drove the herd of horses that used the valley she had found toward a pit trap she had dug. She didn't know the horse that happened to fall into her trap was a nursing mother until she noticed some hyenas stalking the foal. She used her sling to drive the ugly creatures away, rescuing the young horse more because she hated hyenas than because she wanted to save the animal. But once she had saved it, she felt obliged to care for it. She had learned years before that a baby could eat what its mother ate if it was softened and cooked a broth of grains to feed the young filly. Ayla soon came to realize that in saving the horse, she had done herself a favor. She was alone in the valley and became grateful for the company of a living being to share her lonely life. It wasn't her intention to tame the horse, and she never thought of it in those terms. She looked upon the horse as her friend. Later, she became a friend who allowed the woman to ride on her back and who went where Ayla wanted her to go because she chose to. Winnie left to live with a herd for a while when she came into her first season, but came back to Ayla after the herd stallion died. Her foal was born not long after the woman found the wounded man who turned out to be Jandalar. The young colt became his to name and train, finding his own means. He invented the halter to help him direct and control the young stallion. Ayla found the device useful to use on Winnie when she needed to keep her restrained to a specific area, and Jandalar used one if he needed to lead Winnie. He seldom tried to ride the mare, since he didn't fully understand the signals Ayla used to guide her, and the horse didn't understand his. Ayla had a similar problem with Racer. Ayla glanced at Jandalar, who was dashing after a bison, guiding Racer with ease, shaking a grass wand in the face of a young bull to get him stampeding along with the others. She saw a frightened cow veer off and started after her, but Wolf got there first and drove her back. She smiled at the wolf. He was having a wonderful time chasing the bison. They had all, the woman, the man, the two horses, and the wolf, learned to work together and hunt together on their year-long journey following the Great Mother River in their passage across the plains from the east. As they neared the narrow valley, Ayla noticed a man standing off to the side waving at her and breathed a sigh of relief. The hunters had arrived. They would keep the bison heading in the right direction once they were stampeded into the valley. But a couple of bison at the head of the herd were trying to swerve away. She leaned forward, an all but unconscious signal to Winnie to go faster. As though she knew what was in the woman's mind, the mare raced to cut off the bison, reluctant to enter the narrower way. Ayla yelled as Winnie neared, shaking the grass wand and flapping the piece of leather in the canny old cow's face, and managed to turn her back. The rest of the bison followed. The two people on horses and the wolf kept the bison stampeding together and heading in the same direction, but the valley narrowed as they approached the restricted opening of the surround, which slowed them down as they crowded each other. Ayla noticed a bull trying to bolt to get away from the press behind them. A hunter stepped out from behind a panel and attempted to stop him with a spear. The weapon found its mark, but it wasn't a mortal wound, and the momentum kept the bison going. The hunter jumped back and tried to get out of the way by ducking back behind the panel, but it was a flimsy barrier against the mighty bull. Enraged by the pain of the wound, the huge, shaggy animal ignored the panel and knocked it aside. The man fell with it, and in the confusion, the bison trampled him. Ayla, watching in horror, had her spear-thrower out and was reaching for a spear when she saw one thud into the bison. She threw her spear also, then urged Winnie forward, disregarding the danger of other stampeding animals, and jumped off the horse's back even before she stopped. She pulled the panel out of the way and knelt beside the man who was lying on the ground not far from the fallen bison. She heard him moan. He was alive. Chapter 13. Winnie was prancing nervously, sweating heavily, as the rest of the bison swept by and into the surround. When the woman reached for her medicine bag from one of the carrier baskets, she stroked the horse for a moment to comfort her, but her mind was already focused on the man and what she might be able to do for him. She wasn't even aware when the gate to the surround was closed, trapping the bison inside, or when some of the hunters began to methodically dispatch the ones they wanted. The wolf had enjoyed chasing the animals, but even before the gate was closed, he had suddenly stopped running after them and begun searching for Ayla. He found her kneeling beside the wounded man,
Some people began to form a circle around her and the man on the ground, but with Wolf there, they kept their distance. Ayla was oblivious to the people watching her as she began to examine him. He was unconscious, but she could feel a slight beating in his neck under his jaw. She opened his clothing. There was no blood, but a large blue-black smudge was already forming on his chest and abdomen. Carefully, she felt his chest and stomach around the darkening bruise. She pressed in once. He flinched and made a cry of pain, but did not wake up. She listened to his breathing and heard a soft gurgling, then noted that blood dribbled from the side of his mouth and knew he was injured internally. She looked up and saw Jondalar's piercing blue eyes and his familiar frown of concern, and then a second, nearly identical frown with a questioning look. She shook her head at Joharan.
"I'm sorry," she said. "That bison stepped on him."
She looked down at the dead animal beside him.
"His ribs are broken. They are piercing his lungs, and I don't know what else. He is bleeding inside. I'm afraid nothing can be done. If he has a mate, someone should send for her. I'm afraid he will walk the world of the spirits before morning."
"No!"
came a cry from the crowd. A young man pushed his way forward and threw himself down beside the man.
"It's not true. It can't be true. How does she know? Only Azelandani knows. She's not even one of us."
"It's his brother," Joharan said.
The young man tried to hug the man on the ground, then turned the wounded man's head to try to make his brother look at him.
"Wake up, Chevenar. Please wake up,"
the young man wailed.
"Come on, Ranakol. You're not helping him."
The leader of the Ninth Cave tried to help the young man up, but was fought off and pushed away.
"It's all right, Joharan. Let him stay. A brother has a right to say farewell,"
Ayla said. Then, noticing the man starting to stir, she added,
"A brother might cause him to wake up, though, and he will be in pain."
"Don't you have some willow bark or something for pain in your medicine bag, Ayla?"
Jondalar said. He knew she was never without a few basic medicinal herbs. Hunting always posed some danger, and she would have anticipated that.
"Yes, of course. But I don't think he should have anything to drink, not with such severe injuries inside."
She paused, then said,
"But maybe a poultice would help him. I could try it. First we need to get him to some place comfortable, and we'll need wood for a fire and water to boil. Does he have a mate, Joharan?"
she asked again. The man nodded.
"Then someone should go for her, and for Zelindani, too."
"Of course,"
Joharan said, suddenly aware of her strange accent, though he had all but forgotten it until then. Manvalar stepped in.
"Let's get some people looking for a place to take this man, where he can be comfortable away from this hunting field."
"Isn't there a small cave in that cliff over there?" the Fona said.
"There's bound to be one somewhere nearby,"
Kimaran said.
"You're right," Manvalar said. "The Fona, why don't you get some people and go look for a place to take him?"
"We'll go with her,"
Kimaran said, and called over the people from the second and seventh caves who had joined the hunt.
"Bramaval, perhaps you could organize a few people to get wood and water, and we'll have to make something to carry him. Some people brought sleeping rolls. We'll get some for him, and whatever else he needs,"
Manvalar continued. Then he called out to the hunters.
"We need a good runner to take a message back to Two Rivers Rock."
"Let me go,"
Jondalar said.
"I can take the message, and Racer is the best runner here."